guys, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, the Weekend Interview, the website is weekendinterviewshow.com, and also I write for antiwar.com. Next guest is David Enders. He's a freelance reporter from Michigan who has been working in Iraq for most of the last 2 years. He's written for The Nation, The Sunday Times, the BBC, Rolling Stone, and is author of the book Baghdad Bulletin. He has a new article in Mother Jones called, quote, "We regard Fallujah as a large prison," end quote. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and where in Iraq are you right now?
In Baghdad at the moment.
In Baghdad at the moment. And you're only 24 years old, is that right?
That's right.
And how did you end up in Iraq?
I came out here after the invasion with a couple British kids and the intention of starting a magazine. And we ran that for about 6 months right after the invasion with a staff of like 20 persons, largely Iraqi, and some foreign reporters. And then I sort of stayed on and kept working out here after that.
And that was the Baghdad Bulletin.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I guess basically the book is what all was written for the bulletin all compiled together, or?
No. It's mostly just sort of my account of what it was like to be here and sort of operating in that situation. I think it gave us a real unique look at what was happening here. Because while other journalists were sort of ratcheting up their security, we were very mindful of not doing that sort of thing. And, you know, living in a neighborhood in Baghdad without guards and sort of trying as much as was possible to, like, be a part of the community, which is sort of still possible at that point. And then sort of from that, what it became. You know, now I'm sort of stuck here in a fortified hotel complex. There are no foreign troops here, but there are a good number of Iraqi guards and glass barriers. And it's, you know, not safe for me at this point to live outside of this sort of area. Well, I'm in the country. I mean, I'm able to travel around quite a bit, but it's greatly restricted compared to what it used to be. So hopefully it really gives a feel of how stuff on the ground has changed. And there's a few articles from the magazine in there as well that I thought were quite pertinent to the story being told.
How long was that window of opportunity where things were basically stable until things, you know, really started to go downhill, do you think?
Well, things that I wouldn't say were basically ever stable. I mean, there was the chaos of the looting, and then, you know, Baghdad started to come back a little bit, I suppose, up until the first winter after the invasion. And then sort of the invasion of Fallujah the following spring really kind of it off, and I think really radicalized a lot of people and, you know, displaced a number of people who were not quite thrilled about that. And that's when things really started sort of turn. And I think probably also you saw really a real turn of opinion in the Arab world. And I think now probably at this point, a year, more than a year after that, you're starting to see an increased flow of these foreigners who are willing to come into the country and fight as well, in addition to, I think, the Iraqis who have, you know, become radicalized enough to certainly blow themselves up and certainly not, you know, embraced by the government enough to sort of come in and stop fighting. So I don't know if that was the first stability, but certainly for foreigners, it became increasingly dangerous after the first time Fallujah was invaded.
Well, you know, there were studies that recently came out by the Israelis and the Saudis that say that they studied a lot of the suicide bombers that and other terrorists who have gone to Iraq to fight in the jihad, and they're saying that the vast majority, really virtually all of these, are people who are not terrorists before the war, but were, in fact, radicalized by the war. Does that ring true from your point of view?
Yeah, I think I think some of the conduct, and also going with that, shortly after the invasion, the first time Fallujah was invaded, you had the stuff that came out of Abu Ghraib, and I think that played a large part as well. I think for a lot of people, certainly a lot of Iraqis, that was kind of like the last nail in the coffin. People who had been, you know, previously optimistic about the U.S. presence, you know, really just couldn't find anything to be optimistic about at that point.
Now, that original invasion of Fallujah, as you say, was in the spring of 2004, and then they waited until, I guess that was basically a failure. They left, and they came back 6 months later after the election, and basically what's been described as the flattening of Fallujah took place after that. Now, you say in your article, here it's been 8 months, and you've gone now back to Fallujah to investigate the circumstances up there. How are things in Fallujah now after 8 months?
It's not a happy place. You know, a lot of the city was destroyed. There's some rebuilding going on, very little. And people, more than anything, were afraid. You know, they live in a place where their movement is extremely restricted. And you know, they're concerned about the American presence, certainly, and a lot of them even indicated that the Iraqi soldiers were treating them, you know, worse than the Americans had. It was surprising to hear someone in Fallujah say we would prefer the American presence to the presence of the Iraqi soldiers.
Is that because is it because the Iraqi soldiers are Shiites being used to police the Sunni?
I don't think it's even quite as simple as that. In some cases, yeah, you have guys who are members of political parties in the South coming up to fight an area, you know, where a lot of the army officers who they felt oppressed by or were oppressed by, you know, come from. And there's a bit of that. But I think more than anything, it's just sort of the brutality of it. I think, you know, the place, this has been going on long enough that people are starting to breed new beef. I don't think Shiites are joining the army because of what happened in 1991 necessarily. I think some people are joining because they're really appalled by what they're seeing now. And you know, they're making the not untrue you know, assertion that a lot of this is coming out of places like Fallujah, where there's support for resistance to the government through the American troops. And, you know, they're taking sides. It's inevitable. So I think it's more that than anything.
In your article, you say that the checkpoints around Fallujah are up to a kilometer long, razor wire and barricades everywhere. I guess that brings up the question, how is the economy ever supposed to recover from in that kind of situation?
Well, I didn't really look at what the economic growth was. I talked to some other people about that just in other interviews, and then they're saying stuff is getting into the city. It's just getting in very slowly, and obviously not a lot of shops were open. There is, you know, very little commerce. You know, the market's not open like it once was. So certainly that's they're not even there yet in their thinking. No one even talked to me. There's a few people mentioned not having jobs, but I guess in all parts of the world, people mentioned not having jobs.
Is it true?
It's certainly stifled economic activity.
Is it true that they've put retina scanners at the checkpoints that for the people of Fallujah to get in and out of the city, they have to get their eyeballs scanned?
That's true. They do badge people with biometric information, fingerprints and retinal scans. Although And to give you an idea, you know, the fighting is still going on. 96 Marines have been killed since March 27th when MEF-1 took over, another Marine company took over at the end of March. And since that time, they've lost 96 men in Fallujah and had 800 wounded. So I think it's an important thing to mention. And
that's
here they have biometrics and stuff like that.
That's 96 just in Fallujah.
Just in Fallujah.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I don't think those statistics generally get broken out like that. Yeah, they do have the biometrics and the checkpoint. But the first day I managed to walk through with sort of a smile and a nod to the Iraqi soldier in the checkpoint. The Marines are not always in them. They're there. But when I walked through, there was one Marine, and he looked like he had heat stroke. He kind of wasn't paying attention. And so I flashed a press badge and an American passport to the Iraqi soldier. He just smiled and let me go ahead. Which kind of, you know, people described it as a prison state. And certainly I think, you know, they have the option to scrutinize anyone, or if it will and at random. But I was surprised actually how easy it was for me to walk through the checkpoint, with all of, you know, just the Iraqi guys going in and not really be subjected to any scrutiny.
You've written about people pulling you aside to give you the "this is why people don't like America" speech. And I was wondering if you could just rehearse a little bit of that for us. Why is it that people don't like America?
People pay a lot of attention to what our president says. Probably people outside the country pay just as much attention, if not more in some cases, what our president says. And they hear one message coming out, and then here on the ground, what you see gives you a vastly different message. And that, of course, is related in all sorts of, ways. A good one I heard today, I was speaking with one of the women who had been on the governing council appointed by the Americans, and is now part of a contingent of the parliament. He's calling very actively for the parliament to be able to vote on whether or not the Americans should stay. The argument is that the parliament doesn't have sovereignty if it's not allowed to make a decision on what should happen to these foreign troops who they have, you know, invited here. Obviously, and she said that, you know, she worked on the transitional administrative law and has been very close to the U.S. presidency throughout this. And she said Paul Bremer, who was appointed sort of the pro-council of Iraq, initially after the invasion, was a counterterrorism expert and analyst. And this woman, her name is Salama Hafaji, who is on the governing council, just says, Paul Bremer was a counterterrorism expert. And before he came to Iraq, we had no terrorism. And, you know, now look. And so I think that's just, you know, thanks a lot.
Right.
Sort of a thing.
What about the Constitution? There's been, I know that the big fight, basically, they've gone through draft after draft, and they can't even, according to the press I'm reading, they can't even decide whether they're going to have a powerful central state or whether they're going to have federalism or what. Is it the word on the street?
Well,
are people confident that they're going to actually get this thing written on time?
I think people are largely indifferent to what happens. They'll come out and vote. I mean, these are issues that people certainly care about. But, they don't feel, in a few cases, you know, people have been going out and protesting, especially in the case of women's rights. Otherwise, people mostly assume that this is in the hands of a certain group of people, and they'll sort of see what happens. But I think people are engaged to some extent in the process. I talked to a lot of, you know, some of the leaders, even in Fallujah, people were saying that they intend to vote, whether or not that means they're going to vote for or against. People do seem to be, you know, paying a lot of attention to this. And I think, you know, yesterday they did sort of seem to reach some sort of agreement on what the new government would look like. And it seemed to be actually sort of one of the first true compromises to kind of come out of this process. And so hopefully maybe that will hold. It doesn't mean that once they do it and it's voted on, that by any means people will drop their guns. But it's potentially a step. It's not going to, so I don't think, change anything on the ground. At least the paper is not going to give people back electricity or shorten the fuel lines. But I think it's at least probably a step to be granting them some legitimacy. And if people vote on it, that would be, I think, an accomplishment.
Did I just hear you say that the power's not on and that there's lines at the gas station? That can't be right. You're sitting on the second biggest reserve of oil on Earth, aren't you?
Yeah, but getting that out of the ground and refined is a big process. And then getting it to Baghdad, and the electricity is certainly, it's been, you know, 10, 12 hours a day pretty steadily. In some areas less. And people have pretty much gotten used to that. They'd like to see a change, but no one sees it changing anytime soon.
Is it true that it costs $35,000 to get a cab to the airport?
Well, that's if you're taking an insane amount of private security. The cabs from the airport are 15,000 dinars to the center of town, or, you know, like $10.
Okay.
If you want to take a bunch of, foreign guys with guns and have a chase car, it can get that expensive. There's also apparently guys chartering helicopters now between the airport and the Green Zone. I don't know if that's actually in operation.
Hold it there, David. Hold it there, buddy. We're going to be right back after this break, everybody, with David Enders live from Baghdad. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. And right now I'm talking with David Enders. He's a freelance reporter. Talk to him live from Baghdad right now. He's written an article for Mother Jones called "We Regard Fallujah as a Large Prison," and that is Fallujah in newly liberated Iraq. And David, the thing is, I'm not really a big fan of nationalism. However, my biggest hope, I guess, right now for the future of Iraq is that there will be an overriding sense of nationalism on the part of the Kurds and the Sunni and Shia Arabs, that they will put being Iraqi before their ethnicity and try to hold that country together and not break apart into civil war, which I guess is the number one excuse for keeping American troops in Iraq indefinitely, is to prevent that from happening. So I guess my question to you is there any possibility that the people of Iraq can let bygones be bygones and try to hold that country together in some sort of federal system? Or are we going to have to, quote unquote, have to keep American troops there in order to prevent civil war?
Well, I don't know if the sectioning off the country actually results in civil war. Because to some extent you already have, the Kurdish, the three Kurdish provinces in the north are already, for all intents and purposes, autonomous. You know, they have a border that their militia can maintain on its own. And there is no Iraqi military any longer. That's what the Kurds have been, aside from fighting each other on occasion, fighting against for some years. So essentially, you have that remaining as a sort of standard. And then, you know, I think it's inevitable you're going to have greater autonomy for the southern provinces if they are to start to rebuild. It seems the war will go on in Baghdad for a lot longer than you know, it's sort of over in the south. You don't have the same sort of fight taking place there. You know, you have a militia base, but a stronger police force and army. And whether that leads to internal problems in the future remains to be seen. But you do have, you know, the sort of regrouping of the country, and that doesn't necessarily mean full-blown civil war. To some extent, what you already have right now is a civil war. You do have reprisal killings and, you know, sectarian-motivated violence, and essentially at this point, two sides fighting each other. But I do see a possibility in which, you know, you start pulling U.S. troops out, while at the same time certain parts of the country start to normalize. I don't think Iraq will, you know, possibly be returned to the strong central state that it once had.
But you don't see full-scale slaughter in the future either.
Anything possible.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. We're going to have to leave it there. We're all out of time. I appreciate your half hour with me very much, David.
Yeah, thanks. Hope I wasn't too out of it. It's been a long few days.
Oh, no. That's great.
It's like 2 o'clock here. So.
All right, everybody. You can read David Andrews'
blog.
Oh, thank you very much. You can read David's blog at gnn.tv. And also, he writes occasionally for Mother Jones magazine. The current article is called We Regard Fallujah as a Large Prison.